Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to our latest Independent Policy Forum. My name is David Thoreau, and I'm the president of the Independent Institute. We're delighted that you could join with us this evening. I think we have quite an interesting and provocative program, very timely for those of you who follow high technology media and public policy comes and goes. Those of you who are not familiar with the Independent Institute, hopefully you all got a packet. There's background information about our program, including membership and subscription opportunities. I want to point out the new issue, by the way, of our new journal, which we started a while back. And I'd say it's a rather eye-catching cover. The issue has the cover story called Watching You, subtitled Systematic Federal Surveillance of Ordinary Americans. And anyone interested in privacy, I strongly recommend that you take a look at that. The Institute itself is a scholarly public policy research institute. We produce many books in addition to the journal, many other studies and conference and media programs based on that work. Our interest is not to mimic or get involved in political intrigues or political battles. Our interest is to try and get to the heart of public policy disputes and the actual effects of government on these problems. In the packet, you'll also find a sheet on tonight's program. It also lists two of our upcoming policy forums, the next of which will be on November 17th. And that program is on the American Civil War. And the topic of the program is actually human liberty and the roots of American Leviathan. The two speakers are the historian Henry Mayer, who's the National Book Award finalist for his book, All on Fire, on William Lloyd Garrison and the abolition of slavery. And the other speaker is the historian and economist Jeffrey Rogers Hummel, whose book, Emancipating Slaves, Enslaving Free Men, has gotten many people's attention. We'll also be holding an event which is not yet scheduled. It'll be either in December or January with the historian Robert Conquest. We've had Bob speak in the past, about 5 years ago, almost 6 years ago, I guess. Bob has a new book out called Reflections on a Ravaged Century. For those of you not familiar with Dr. Conquest, he is the author of a number of landmark books, including The Great Terror, Harvest of Sorrow, Stalin, and other books, especially on the Soviet Union. Tonight's program is one that we're very pleased to be hosting. We're very pleased that we have two excellent speakers on this topic. For those of you who are not familiar with this book, we highly recommend that you get a copy. It's a book that we think is not just important, but perhaps even revolutionary in the whole field of commerce and money and finance and privacy. Our first speaker tonight is an economist who has been involved in a whole range of fields. He's the author of The End of Money. The End of Money, I should mention, is published by our friends at the Discovery Institute in Seattle, who've been very helpful with us on many occasions, including helping us arrange for Richard this evening. Almost daily, it seems, there seems to be some sort of event pertaining to the issues that we're going to be discussing this evening, especially in the world of public policy. Many of you may remember the recent proposal and the fight to stop a program called Know Your Customer, which was a series of regulations that would have dramatically changed people's financial situation as far as the government's involvement, at least monitoring-wise. But it seems like there's almost a daily proposal, or we hear reports of discussions of proposals for the government to monitor financial records, to wiretap, to monitor email, to censor the internet, to tax website transactions, and so forth. Indeed, the prospects of a world in which private transactions are uncontrollable by government is something that many politicians and bureaucrats are not too pleased about. The procedure we're going to use tonight is I'll first introduce Dr. Richard Rahn, and he'll be followed by our second speaker, Peter Thiel, and afterward we'll have questions from you for both speakers. Richard Rahn is president and Chief Executive Officer of Novacon Limited and Senior Fellow at the Discovery Institute. Dr. Ron formerly served as Vice President and Chief Economist at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and Editor-in-Chief of the Journal of Economic Growth. He received his Ph.D. in Business Economics from Columbia University, and he served as the U.S. Co-Chairman of the Bulgarian Economic Growth and Transition Project. He's also been Executive Director of the American Council for Capital Formation in Washington. He's also been Washington Economic Consultant for the New York Mercantile Exchange, Professor of Management and Head of the Graduate Department of Management at Polytechnic University. He's been National Executive Director of the Ripon Society and a member of faculties at numerous universities, including Florida State, Rutgers, George Washington, and George Mason University. Richard is someone who has been a leading light in a whole number of cutting-edge economic areas, but I'll let him discuss one tonight. I'm very pleased to introduce Dr. Richard Ron.
Well, David, thank you very much for having me here. I've been very impressed with the work of the Discovery Institute, and particularly your new journal here. I thought the one eye was in honor of me, but as David mentioned, I live in Virginia, but I work in downtown Washington. Recently became aware that I spent much of my working life within six blocks of the White House. It's been the longer six blocks in the last 8 years than I had been previously, or the last 7 years, I guess it's been now. Washington is that place where our former esteemed mayor once said, the crime rate in Washington wouldn't be bad at all if it wasn't for all the murders. Tonight I'm here to talk about the future world and the future of money specifically. And my interest in the topic goes back many years, and the great Nobel Prize-winning economist Keynes had talked about the denationalization of money, of currency, and this seemed somewhat futuristic, and a number of us had sort of played with the notions for many years. Hayek, yeah, who did I say? Keynes, no. I'll tell you what happened. I was talking tonight to Bert Knapp. He told me he knew Keynes. That's what I was thinking about Keynes. Of course, it was Hayek, Friedrich Hayek. And I never knew Keynes. Keynes died a long time ago. Bert remembers him, but I don't. But I did know Hayek, as many of you here, David and others knew. And we had played around with his concepts and see if he could make it a reality. And it looked very difficult. But suddenly the world changed. Technology changed. And we had the development of the internet, low-cost computing power, sort of the end of bandwidth, and by that I mean low-cost international telecommunication. In fact, with the internet, it's getting to be almost free. The rise of public key encryption. All these things came together. And so what Hayek had talked about suddenly was possible. And when I was working in Eastern Europe, in Bulgaria and Hungary and Estonia, and particularly Russia and the former Soviet Union, we were trying to see how we could create new payment systems. In these countries, there were no checking systems. There were no clearing systems, as those of you who know about banking at all. Nobody had checking accounts. Everything was done in cash. It was a very primitive economy in many ways. So we thought, well, maybe we'll just skip checks altogether and go right to electronic commerce, and that caused me to start investigating what was the state of the art, looking at things like smart cards and other types of digital transfers. And then I found that virtually nothing was being written upon this in the standard economic literature. The Journal of the American Economic Association and others were not talking about this. But in places like Wired Magazine, they were. And the people who were doing that understood what the technologies could do, but they didn't understand much about international monetary mechanics. So I tried to bring them together all in this book, along with looking at the various public policy issues involved. Now, this stuff that we all carry around here with us, you know, this is, here's a dollar bill. This one is an old one. It's got Robert Rubin's name on it, so it can't be that old. But anyway, it's wrinkled and it's dirty. You know, they carry a lot of germs, and they find that like 60% of them have traces of cocaine on them. So if they ever want to bust you, they just pick up your money and say, aha, there's a trace of cocaine, because virtually all money has it. But this is a rather primitive way of doing things, and it's even worse with coins. You know, we all carry around some of these coins, and you never have the right set of coins and these things to for the vending machines or the parking meters or the other things where you need them. Of course, in the digital age, all that can disappear, because we can go to smart cards, which is nothing more than like a credit card with a chip in it, where you can actually put the money in a card called cash purse. But the really radical change that's taking place is real-time settlements. The reason you have this stuff is this is a non-earning asset. And even with low levels of inflation, you lose 1 or 2% of the value of it each year. And most of us carry around some quantity of this stuff. And the reason we do it, and it has, you know, what's the value of that piece of paper? Not much. But the but it's because there's a time period between getting rid of one productive asset and acquiring another productive asset or a good or service we want. But in the digital age, this time period can collapse to a fraction of a second. And suddenly the need for money as we normally thought of it begins to disappear. Now you still need a numeraire in which to make transactions. You know, we have to have the dollar or euro or something that we define relative values in. But the existence of money as we traditionally think of it, that is going to disappear. And it's going to disappear fairly rapidly. The technologies are now there. And I expect many of you here are involved in various aspects of technologies, which will have an impact on that. But just think about it here in the next few years, over the internet, from your home computer or from your telephone, you will be able to take money and transfer it around the world virtually at the speed of light. Not only that, with advances in public key encryption, you can easily encrypt it just with a couple keystrokes on your computer, and no government or anybody else will know what you've done. And with the new public key encryption, it's almost impossible for NSA to break. Fortunately, being in Washington, I had access to a lot of high-ranking CIA and NSA people and others who are sort of panicked about this development, because in the old days, if somebody wanted to tap your phone, it wasn't done as it was done in the movies. You know, they didn't have to have somebody break in your office to tap your phone. It was all done down the telephone company. People don't realize that. They got a court order, and the telephone company was all set up, and on the old analog systems, they basically just listened in, and they knew what was going on. Telephone companies switched over to the digital system. Suddenly, it became a whole lot more difficult. But the phone companies would give the FBI or the NSA or CIA or whoever they wanted to listen in their codes to their digital systems so they could listen in. But suddenly, that's to say that David here wants to send a private message to Peter. Well, with public key encryption, this is easily done. You just download these programs and get them off the internet or buy them from any software store, and you can transmit messages. And the courts fortunately have ruled that encryption is protected under the First Amendment. It's freedom of speech. And so you can use whatever level you want, and for all intents and purposes, two of you can have messages that NSA or nobody else, clearly the FBI, cannot break. The Clinton administration and Janet Reno's Department of Justice came up with a proposal a couple months ago. They said, well, this is just terrible. We can't let this happen, have people have private conversations. And so they had a proposal to allow the FBI to break into your home and put devices on your computers to read the keystrokes you are making, because it didn't do them any good any longer to actually get the message. But if they could get in to see what David was actually typing on his computer before he encrypted it, what Peter was decrypting, then they could know what was going on. Well, fortunately, we still have enough people in the Congress who said this was outrageous, it did not go anyplace, and the administration seems to have backed off on it. But this is the continuing struggle between financial privacy and these new technologies, because these new technologies will be very liberating. Now, in a digital world, there's not much reason for the Federal Reserve to produce money anymore. This says a Federal Reserve note. This is part of the U.S. debt. You know, when you hear about how much debt we have, this stuff you carry around in your pocket is part of the debt. And just as an aside, I've been sort of interested in all these folks talking about paying off the federal debt. Well, if we paid off the debt, what would we use for our money? But I don't think you have to worry about that. But we won't have a need for Federal Reserve notes, and most of the money will be supplied by private institutions. Now, it doesn't have to be supplied by banks. And I think the banks are facing a very difficult future, because in the digital age, there's no reason McDonald's or Microsoft or Boeing or any other well-known company can't go ahead and start supplying money. You know, before we had the Federal Reserve System in 1914, and I know Burke remembers this, but then we had most money in the U.S. was privately issued and by individual banks. Now, the federal government defined the dollar, you know, in terms of gold or silver and a variety of things over time. But the government defined what the value of the currency was. But most of the money was actually issued by banks. And well-known banks like Citibank or Bank of America and so forth, their money would trade at par. And a lesser-known bank, they might have a discount on it. But the same thing is likely to happen in the digital age. I'm not sure how all this will sort off. But if you had something that said a McDonald dollar, well, most people figure McDonald's probably a pretty strong corporation. You're surely familiar with the name, and you'd probably be willing to accept them. Much like the frequent flyer miles that airlines now have, and they're starting to be used for not just airline purchases, but for other products. They're beginning to have, Well, no, not yet, but they're beginning to expand out. And what I think you'll see is companies, maybe like McDonald's, I know Burger King's already done one experiment, with a frequent purchase program where they give you a smart card and you can get, what's it, Whoppers at Burger King, right? You get five, I'm trying to remember what all these, which fast food franchise has which, but you can get like five Whoppers for the price of four if you have the smart card and you buy smart cards for other people. But there'll be a tendency to allow these to be used for other purchases. So it'll evolve in a number of different ways. In Europe, it's much more evolved than it is here in many countries. Places like Finland, you can use smart cards and parking meters. But just think of something like a vending machine. Vending machines have these electromechanical devices in them for putting dollar bills in, and like a wrinkled old dollar bill like this, it'll probably be rejected. These things break down. Drug addicts and thieves break into them, and they're expensive to maintain, they're expensive to produce. But if you go into the digital world and you just stick a card in, or you just flash your card by it, because some of them have, it can be read by infrared, and that just takes out the 75 cents or a dollar or whatever it is for the item you want on the vending machine, the vending machine has digits in it. There's no incentive for anybody to break in. These little card reader writers are a fraction of the cost of the electromechanical devices we now use. Think in parking meters, where you don't have to run out every few minutes and put new quarters in the thing. It's timed. That's already done in Finland and a number of other places. So we have this radical new world, which is well on its way, and it's going to be a much better world. Now, when I talk about this and I say that we won't move totally to digital money unless we have the same degree of anonymity as we have with this. And people want to make a number of anonymous purchases, both for good and not so good reasons. But you don't want to have a trail for everything you produce or everything you buy. At least most people don't. And when David wants to pick up his copy of Hustler, he may not want Mary to see that on his credit card. And, is that true? Yeah. So he probably uses cash when he does that. And people have lots of reasons of not wanting to have a total electronic trail of everything they bought. And so I think it's very important we maintain the anonymity. You got to have the privacy. You don't want to have total big brotherism. Now, there are a bunch of people in Washington, Justice Department, the FBI, and other places, say, oh, no, this is terrible. We want to know what everybody earns. We want to see every cent that goes into them and every cent that goes out. I think our founding fathers would be appalled at this concept, but this is, there is the kind of battles that are going on. And they've resisted the movement towards anonymous digital money systems. I got sort of fed up with listening to their arguments of how we can't have anonymity. And they usually say because you have increases tax evasion and money laundering and drug dealing. So I looked up the data. Last year, 932 individuals were convicted of money laundering in the U.S. 932. A population is 270 million. We had 18,000 murders. Now, how many of those people were killed because somebody was trying to take somebody else's this stuff? Good share of those. We had several million robberies, several tens of millions of thefts. Most of it was trying to get this stuff. If you go to a digital world, you greatly reduce the opportunities for crime. The convenience stores, the all-night convenience stores, the gas stations, banks, and so forth, which are prone to having people come with guns to hold them up. If there's no money there, what are you going to steal? Now, you can steal somebody's smart card, but you can have any degree of security you want on a smart card. You can have them, so if somebody steals it, they can use it. Or you can put a PIN code or a thumbprint or a voice print or facial profiles, all kinds of things you can do with them. If you, whatever level of security you want. So I think that the argument about crime is bogus. It is basically a battle over big brothers in Washington wanting to monitor every bit of your behavior. You know, this history of looking into people's bank accounts is quite new. Traditionally, and again, Burke remembers this, that gentlemen did not want to the gentlemen didn't read other gentlemen's mail, and they didn't look into their bank accounts. That was considered privacy. And actually, from the time of the Magna Carta in our Anglo-Saxon tradition, we had this concept of privacy. And governments had not had the authority, generally, to look into people's bank accounts. That changed in 1933. Hitler's Germany was the first country to put down a law to deny financial privacy. It is a decree made by Hitler in 1933 called for the protection of the state and the individual. For your protection. Doesn't this sound sort of familiar? And so this gave the German government the right to look at everybody's bank account. And this is the thing that caused a lot of Germans, particularly German Jews, to move their money out of Germany to Switzerland and other places, to try to hide it from the authorities because it was setting up procedure. Again, as a little aside on this, you might have been reading these stories about the Bank of New York and this Russian money laundering thing. I'm willing to bet that virtually nobody will get convicted of money laundering because I've read through a lot of this. This is basically flight capital. I've been to Russia 31 times in the last 9 years. I know the country fairly well. I've been all over it. I've been an economic advisor there. The Russian government has stolen the savings of the people at least 3 times over the last dozen years. They've stolen it by inflation. And when you have hyperinflation, I mean, that's the government doing nothing more than stealing the money. So you've had, some poor Russian woman who has saved up for many years, put her money in the state savings account, and that has been a little nest egg. And 3 times in the last dozen years, it's been totally wiped out. So any sensible Russian, of course, is going to put their money in dollars. Most Russians hold currency. In fact, 70% of the U.S. currency is outside the country. They want to, and they want to get their dollars, they're not only in Russia, but they worry about them being seized there, but of course they want to get them out. That is sensible. If you were faced with the same kind of economic situation in Russia, you would also want to get your money out. Now, I don't think the people who want to get the money out are the criminals. I look at the government as being the criminal. And we get this all backwards, because the government has been engaged in theft. And inflation is theft. We can spend a lot of time on this, but I think probably most of you are well aware of that phenomenon. I'm not going to talk much about the technology, because Peter's been more deeply involved in much than I have. So I'll concentrate on some of the public policy aspects. One of the big battles, as I've already mentioned, is the battle over encryption. And there has been these attempts to try to deny encryption or keep low levels. And if you have a low enough level of encryption, then of course the FBI or the NSA or others can get into it. And again, we've been lucky that the courts have ruled in our favor domestically with the First Amendment guarantee. So then the government fell back to trying to control the exports of encryption. My laptop PC, I've got encryption program in it. Now, if I took that out and took it overseas, now they actually say I can have it in my laptop for my own personal use even when I'm traveling. But if I sold it to somebody, then I could be in trouble. Of course, these same encryption programs you get for free over the internet. And encryption is something, because it's mathematical algorithms, so how do you control it? I first came aware of the stupidity of the government's position, I think it was back in about 94, that we were trying to set up electronic payment systems in Russia and moving to smart cards and so forth. And I was working with a Russian smart card company that was providing software for the reader writers and things. And they wanted the up-to-date stuff on encryption. There's a guy named Bruce Schneier that probably many of you know, who has got the sort of basic Bible of encryption. So I said, I'll bring his book over. It's a big seller here in the U.S. In the back cover of his book, he's got two discs that have the algorithms which were written out in the text. In the back of the book, you have the algorithms, but he also had them on this, so you could just drop them in your computer. Well, when we were ordering the books, Bruce had called up and talked to one of my associates, and he said to her, you know, if you're going to take these out of the country, you got to take the disk out, because those are considered munitions. The same algorithms were actually in the book. I mean, you just had to scan it and put it back in the computer, but since it was written, that's freedom of speech and protected by the First Amendment. But the discs were considered munitions. And the more I got into this and looked at the whole stupidity of this thing. And so the government's trying to control something you can't control. Now, the software companies who provide encryption programs, they've been a big disadvantage because they've had to set up offshore operations to market this. And so much of the encryption programs have moved over to Japan, Switzerland, and Belgium, and Finland, and other places which don't have any restrictions on it. And finally, the administration seems to be beginning to back off on it. But it's much like so many things in Washington, the people are brain dead. It's much like Prohibition. I mean, Prohibition clearly couldn't work because there was a demand for alcoholic beverages. I know that shocks you. But there was a demand for alcoholic beverages. And people knew how to make wine. They knew how to make beer, bathtub gin. I'm not sure I know how to make bathtub gin. I'm a Virginian, and we're slow to learn these things. But anyway, all this was out, and of course, it was ludicrous that if there's a demand, the supply isn't going to be there. And there's a demand for high-level encryption, and people are going to get it, and it's easy because the basic fundamentals of how you do public key encryption now are known. If any of you are interested, there's plenty of books out there on it. I've got some of them referenced in my book. But this was the you know, there's a whole loony policy in Washington. The other big battle, of course, is over bank secrecy. We have something called the Bank Secrecy Act passed in 1970. But in typical Washington fashion, the Bank Secrecy Act is actually the anti-Bank Secrecy Act because it forces your banker to spy upon you. It prohibits banks from giving bank secrecy, even though it's called the Bank Secrecy Act. And originally, they had a limit of $10,000 in cash transactions, and there was these currency transaction reports the banks had to file. And that was in 1970, would be, $40,000 today. But they kept lowering the level, and they made it 5 and down to 3. And then David talked about the Know Your Customer regs, which is going to bring it down to 0. When I was doing the book, I went around and talked to a number of bank compliance officers for big banks. And they were talking about the huge cost of having to train all their personnel to look for suspicious activities. You know, David, let's say he normally takes $100 of cash on a week, spending cash on a checking account. Suddenly, one week, David goes in and takes up $300. Aha! A suspicious activity. A report goes to Washington. And if banks don't do that, they're fine. It's a huge burden. So I started looking at the cost of this for the whole banking system. Well, it ran into hundreds of billions of dollars. And then I looked at the number of convictions. Now, I calculated that the convictions seem to cost more than $100 million when you look per conviction, if you look at the total public and private sector cost. And everybody was screaming about Ken Starr spending $44 million and he got 17 convictions. Well, FinCEN, the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, is out there, and their numbers are like $100 million conviction. And I've debated some of their people, and they've never come back with figures to prove me wrong. So I suspect my numbers are too low. The other area is taxation. And taxation, this is a fascinating problem. I assume that there's probably a libertarian leaning in this audience. No, no. Well, friends of David. Okay. David gave me 1 minute here. Let's see if I can do it all in 1 minute. Okay. This book. Now think about it. Let's assume I had written in London rather than in Virginia, and that I had a British publisher, but I had a printer in Toronto, Canada, a wholesaler in Memphis, Tennessee, that when I sold it through Amazon.com, a Seattle, Washington company with warehouses in Reno, Nevada, if a Virginia resident had been on vacation in Florida and with their portable computer had ordered from Amazon using a credit card, a Visa card on a Bermudan bank. Now, please tell me, who would have the right to tax the transaction and how would you enforce it? And you've got all these states talking about internet taxation. There's a moratorium right now. It's lunacy. And last spring, the state of California, there was a group there formed a task force to come up with how they would tax it. Then they brought a few of us in, some of the fellows in the big accounting firms, and the tax accountants, and a few tax lawyers, and a couple of economists like myself who commented on this. And it took us about an hour and a half to take these people apart, not because we were so much smarter, but the problems of internet taxation are overwhelming. And you even have to have a massive violation of civil liberties, of monitoring everything. And the final word, since he's cutting me off here, is that think about the electronic age. If there is an electronic hole any place in the world, if any country, any place in the world decides not to go along with these controls, everything flows through it. And what this is going to force, I think, is a downsizing of government, which is good. But we've got a huge battle in front of us because the totalitarian forces which reside in Washington, we don't even realize they're totalitarian forces. That's part of the shame of it all. They come up with these things and they don't realize they're Hitler juniors. You know, they think they're doing it to help us. But we've got it is going to be a big effort over the next few years, and we have to win the battle. We've pretty well won the battle on encryption. It's not over yet, but pretty well won that. the bank secrecy, we've got a lot of work to do there, and the tax battles are the two big ones. And I hope you will all join in the fight. Dave, again, thank you. And tell everybody to buy this book.
It matters to me whether they buy it.
It matters to us, too.